Adigan, 11-1888. You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Garrison. Jeff Brandt for defendant appellant Adebisi Adigan. Although Mr. Adigan had briefed in the opening brief three Fourth Amendment issues and a procedural pretrial, or I should say pre-plea issue, we obviously have to concede that in response to the government's brief, we cannot stand before this court and say the plea was conditional. I can tell the court from information and belief that we did understand both from Mr. Adigan and from one of his prior attorneys, the understanding was that it was conditional. But because the first element of this court's test is whether the government contests it, and the government does, that's not an issue. We do continue to ask this court to take jurisdiction over it, however, and cite Seventh Circuit case law in support. Two cases that we have found. And on that point, I need to make a note on my brief. I say several Seventh Circuit cases. I remember typing that when I got a Lexis search that brought up 20 cases. Based upon my search, after review of those 20 cases, only two of them used those exact words in this context. It's not several. I only found two published. Those are Robinson and Dvorak, and I believe Judge Mannion, you were on both of those. In Robinson, it was a guilty plea. There was no written plea agreement. The defendant wanted to appeal venue and counsel of choice issues. Those issues were ruled upon by the district court below. So this court saw a district court decision, a reasoned decision. What did the district court think? Well, let's decide whether we're going to take jurisdiction and review it or not. This court decided to hear it. And Dvorak, which Judge Castillo, I believe you were district court judge, so you may even remember that one, there was a guilty plea to an information. Again, there was no written plea agreement. He wanted to appeal a question of whether the information was manipulated. And this court said, well, that wasn't preserved. The government responded that the issues had been waived. But this court, again, agreed to hear it. The government's they rightfully point out, I didn't see the Combs case when doing the opening brief. We've got the Combs case now. What's different? It's a late motion to suppress. The district court judge never even gets to the actual suppression issues. It's the ruling is, no, you can't raise that late. We're not going to get to that. This court in Combs decides, no, we're not going to take jurisdiction over that. It appears to be an intra-circuit split. We would ask the court to follow Robinson and Dvorak, as they seem to be more similar to this case here. Again, no written plea agreement. Issues that have been reviewed by a district court, fleshed out completely to the point that Judge Murphy even grants one of the suppression issues at one point. And if there's a question of whether there's a difference between a Fourth Amendment issue and a procedural pre-plea issue, like whether the motion for reconsideration was rather a reconsideration at all or something else that should have been denied on procedural grounds and under this court's case law when it comes to civil reconsideration, because there's no technical criminal reconsideration motion, we'd ask at a minimum look at that issue.
So you're asking us to distinguish Combs or to overrule Combs?
I would hope that the court would recognize the intra-circuit split, resolve it for the bar, but yeah, for my client's sake, find that either maybe they jive somehow in the court's opinion, that there are differences. Maybe the difference is whether the district court, you know, we can actually read what the district court decided and do what a court of appeals is supposed to do and decide whether that determination was right and say under Alano, look, we see what the district court did. Maybe you didn't preserve it, but we can make a determination of justice now and then follow a Robinson and a Dvorak, whether by overruling Combs or whether distinguishing it.
Don't you think Combs at least creates a bright line rule for district court judges to follow and for all the litigants to realize that if you want to have a conditional plea, it has to be in writing with acquiescence by all three parties?
I think it's obviously better to have a bright-line rule. Mm-hmm. I think the bar has to concede that. I have to concede that. Mm-hmm. But we also have to recognize that there are reasons for plain error analysis. Mm-hmm. There's a reason for a Robinson and Dvorak exception, mm-hmm. if it's an exception. Maybe there is a rule and a bright-line rule, which we should have in the district court so we can do our, mm-hmm. our jobs right, and the district court should have something to rely on. I agree.
You believe the appellant here believed he had the right to conditionally appeal?
I believe the record, the answer is yes, and I believe the record bears that out. Why does a defendant ask for an appeal bond mm-hmm. before sentencing mm-hmm. if he doesn't think he's going to appeal something that's going to lead to his exoneration or legal exoneration? Mm-hmm. Why does a defendant turn down an 8-year deal to take a higher deal? What, to appeal the sentence? No, that's why you take an 8-year deal. It's 2 years under the mandatory minimum. I think the record shows that he was on a track toward appealing to this court and getting these issues in front of it. And that's why we cite the Ninth Circuit case, couldn't find a Seventh Circuit one, that stands for the proposition that, look, okay, it's not conditional, but this record doesn't show it's unconditional either. Remand for the defendant to have the opportunity to plead anew.
But that Ninth Circuit case, I took a look at that. In that case, there was a defendant who I think at least offered the court a conditional plea in writing, and that was rejected. And then there's some ambiguity.
Yeah, I think the ambiguity is different in the two cases. Mm-hmm. I can't say that the ambiguity here is not that there was something in writing. Mm-hmm. I don't think there could have been anything in writing in this case. The mm-hmm. defendant pleaded guilty the first day of trial.
As
we're waiting. They're watching
waiting,
a video, getting ready to come up. Judge Murphy's, let's go. Let's get this thing done.
I took a look at the Rule 11 colloquy, and what is interesting about it to me as a district court judge is that there's no mention of waiver of appeal at all. Because usually, at least in my Rule 11 colloquy, when I talk to a defendant about waiving their trial rights, I also tell them that they're giving up their right to appeal all the rulings that I would make as a district court judge before, during, and after the trial, including the verdict of guilty itself. But Judge Murphy, for whatever reason, just doesn't have a word about that. And there's just no mention by the prosecution or the defense on any waiver of appeal or any right to retain the right to appeal.
This was a discussion in our office. Mm-hmm. And I hesitated to raise that issue because you're absolutely right, and mm-hmm. it's an issue. I didn't want to fall into a trap of saying, mm-hmm. Judge Murphy didn't go over this type of appeal waiver, which is required by subsection N of Rule 11. Mm-hmm. But that's not the same. I can't say that, mm-hmm. and that means we win. But I do believe, Judge, you're absolutely correct that that's a problem. But it's not the same problem.
You think there's a Rule 11 violation with the plea?
There's a Rule 11 violation in failing to address an appeal waiver mm-hmm. if there had been an appeal waiver in writing. I can't say mm-hmm. there is one because there was no written plea agreement. Mm-hmm. I just think, as Your Honor does, it's interesting that the issue of appeal didn't come up at all mm-hmm. and helped show that there's this. We can't look mm-hmm. at this record and say this record shows an unconditional plea. It's just not coming up.
Rule 11 requires you to advise the defendant of their waiver of their trial rights. But my recollection of Rule 11 doesn't require you to advise them that a defendant is giving up implicitly some appellate rights in waiving their trial rights.
That's correct, Your
Honor. You agree with that?
I do, Your Honor. No further questions.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Brandt. Ms. Garrison.
The court. Good morning, Your Honors. I don't believe that there can be any question whatsoever that this was an unconditional plea. Notably, Rule 11 requires the consent and permission of the district court for the entry of a conditional plea, and there was absolutely no dialogue whatsoever with the district court about appeal. It was noted that this was an open plea and that there was no plea agreement. And certainly nothing has been argued on appeal about any Rule 11 violation. And certainly Rule 11 does not require the district court to advise the defendant that he will not be able to appeal pretrial rulings.
And let me ask you this. So I take it in your office there's no standard practice to alert the judge or to ask the judge to ask about waiver. Because, of course, if that question had been asked, we wouldn't even be here today. Or, I mean, you know, so do you think it would be a better practice to ask the court to go through the waiver questioning with the defendant?
I can tell Your Honor that typically if a plea is scheduled well in advance, whether it's pursuant to a plea agreement or it's an open plea, there's a written document. And it's submitted to the court by way of courtesy copy in advance. So typically, that is how a judge.
And that provision would be in your standard written plea agreement.
If there is an appeal waiver, that is set forth in writing, and the court covers that in the colloquy. Of course, you understand you're giving up the right to appeal. Each of the judges varies a little bit in the colloquy, but if it's an open plea, it is typically noted, and you have no plea agreement with the government. Mm-hmm. It isn't really ever emphasized that, you know, of course, this means you can't revisit my denial of your motion to dismiss the indictment or your challenge to venue or anything like that. I mean, a defendant...
That just doesn't come up.
It doesn't come up, and I think the reason why it doesn't come up is because, you know, the defendant goes in and he is admitting guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, when there's an open plea, and I think it's exactly the place where we were in this case. Mm-hmm. This was no longer an issue about guilt. I mean, about 2 days before, the defendant had taken the stand mm-hmm. at another hearing on the suppression issue and had admitted guilt. Mm-hmm. He admitted guilt during that hearing, and I think what this became about was a case about the penalty to be imposed. Because there was very much of an issue about, okay, of this powder cocaine found in the car, how much was going to be sold in powder form and how much was to be sold in the form of crack cocaine? That makes a dramatic difference, certainly pre-FSA, and this is a pre-FSA case. So I think that's exactly where we were. I mean, the judge had noted in reversing his decision on the motion to suppress that this defendant was an accomplished liar. He had no credibility whatsoever. The dynamic one can see that it made a lot of sense for this defendant to plead, get some points for acceptance of responsibility, and make his best arguments that possible at sentencing about the consequences of his conduct. And indeed, he prevailed in his sentencing arguments. I think the PSR called for a low-end range of about 235 months. Ultimately, after hearing the testimony of two witnesses, Judge Murphy found the low-end, I think, was about 151 months and imposed a sentence at the low-end of the range. That's really where we were in the case.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about revisiting the suppression issue. And here's something else that's interesting. I mean, certainly below, the most hotly contested suppression issue was suppression motion number one. And now on appeal, we're also looking at suppression motion, I think, number four. Ultimately, there were about five, with this whole stop on March 10th. And clearly, if there had been a conditional plea, when you've had five motions to suppress, because there's been two different sets of confessions to police officers and there's been two separate warrantless searches, we certainly would be talking about which of these raft of motions are you preserving and which do you not wish to revisit. And, of course, none of that happened. And I would have to say, having been involved in the case below, having met the defendant, spoken with him personally, one cannot simply read this record and say, gee, he must have thought he was going to be able to appeal this or he wouldn't have pled guilty. I mean, we certainly cannot engage in that kind of speculation. I suppose there will be a time and place for exploring whether he thought he could appeal, what he was told about that.
He had some college education, according to the record.
He did, and he was here on a visa, allegedly, to go to school and testified he had some college education. He was not an experienced drug dealer by any means, and we had a strong interest in making a reasonable offer and moving on to the next case, and that was the basis for the negotiations. I mean, Judge Murphy found that this was not a close call on the whole standing issue. I mean, there is varieties of different stories given by this defendant under oath about how he came to be in possession of a car that he did not own, that had unregistered plates, that was later reported stolen. And certainly one can tell some of the tenor of Judge Murphy's sentiments toward this defendant by reading the record, and it just doesn't really strain the imagination to think that he knowingly and willfully, you know, pled guilty, admitted guilt, as he had done 2 days before, and decided that this was going to be about his sentencing exposure.
So to get back to my original question, though, there would be no question or no issue about this if it was a standard practice in the district, whether someone was doing an open plea or a written plea agreement, for the district judge to engage in a colloquy where the judge would say, you understand by pleading guilty, you're giving up the right to appeal anything that I've ruled on earlier. I mean, there's no harm in that. I mean, that all that could do would be to build a better record, so it wouldn't even be an issue on appeal.
It is, in many cases, there would be no harm in doing that, such as cases in this where there had been a hotly disputed issue. In many other cases, you know, the more we advise a defendant at a colloquy, sometimes the more confusing it can be. Depending
on the job of the judge to make clear what their rights are. I mean, I understand there's a certain risk. I mean, when one realizes how many rights one are giving up, it may cause one to pause, but isn't in the best interest of justice to make sure people understand exactly what it is they are agreeing to. I guess that's what I'm getting to. You know, and I understand that by being advised, it may cause a defendant to hesitate, or the judge might have to say, well, then if you've got some issue with this, let's take a little recess, go out and explain what this waiver really means. I'm talking about avoiding appeals, because if there are certain practices in place, like this issue, this wouldn't even be an issue. We wouldn't even be here if there had been an oral waiver.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Rule 11 itself does provide some notice. I mean, it is the bright line rule. And we certainly...
And, of course, I understand that Rule 11 says that. If it's conditional, it has to be in writing. I get that. We all get that because we're lawyers and we're judges and we get that. Regular defendants, though, you know, this guy admittedly was not an experienced criminal, right?
He was an experienced criminal. He was a felon.
Remind me of his record. So he was a record.
He
was an experienced drug dealer. But my point is just, from a practical standpoint, when we get up to do a plea or when a plea is taken, that if this is one question that is asked, albeit not required by Rule 11, from a practical standpoint, it eliminates future appeal.
It could.
In this area.
Yes, it could, Your Honor. And
that's my only point. And it's a practice that your office might want to consider. That's all.
And Your Honor would suggest as well, I mean, it.
And this issue of, well, it might make people hesitate because if they knew all their rights, their full rights, you know, to me is not a legitimate.
Oh, I didn't mean it to come out that way, Your Honor. It's just sometimes if a colloquy gets very long and there's things that aren't even applicable, such as, and you're waiving DNA testing, and there was never any DNA evidence gathered.
That's a different kind of situation. And, you know, I've been in your shoes, too, because I was a former assistant U.S. attorney. So I know what the dynamics are with respect to getting a plea. I don't need to say anything more about it. I'm just saying it's something you might want to think about.
Well, Your Honor, I would just say that certainly nothing happened during the colloquy to make anyone think that the suppression issue was really in anyone's mind at that point in time.
I understand. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does he have?
speak really fast. I'm just kidding. I can't speak for the defense bar, but I think the defense bar would probably agree that it would be better to slow down plea hearings, because so often as a defense attorney, whether it's a court-appointed case or a retained case, the complaint more often than not is I didn't understand what was happening. Mm-hmm. I got bonked over the head thinking I was buying a stereo, and I got an 8-track player. So it would be a good judicial resources.
About Cook County. I mean, we're talking everywhere. About federal court where there is a, you know, the volume, the caseload volume is not as great, it's not as high, but.
Yes, Your Honor. We'd submit that standing is a close call. We respect the judge's view, but we believe standing is a close call, and we submitted it was waived because the standing issue wasn't addressed by anybody in the hearing. It's not until a month later that it's brought up. And the government says that this case became a sentencing issue near the end and not suppression, but that is exactly contradicted by the defendant's actions. He showed it wasn't about sentencing, because if it were about sentencing, he would have taken an 8-year deal. It's clearly not about sentencing. The government might felt it was because they've got a conviction, and now they want to see, is he going to do a lot of time? Are we going to push for a lot of time? Are we going to use resources to get a lot of time? Or are we going to have a day-long sentencing hearing? But the defendant's actions show that's not what it was about, because if it were about sentencing, it would have taken an 8-year deal. We thank the court.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Thank you, counsel, both for your fine briefs and your oral argument. We'll take the cases under advisement. Court will stand in recess till the next session.